The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, is this amplifying enough? Something the Buddha said. Luminous is this mind, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. So this is, of course, a translation of something the Buddha said, but I'd like to look at the words here a little bit and see what this means. Explore this a little bit, what this means. So the first word I'd like to explore a little bit is mind. He says, luminous is this mind. And mind, the mind that the Buddha is talking about, the word translated is probably citta, which is used in different ways, but can often be understood not to just mean what we usually think of as mind, a mental, you know, the head where we think, reflect. Often we think of mind as being intellectual, but the word mind that's being translated here actually includes the heart qualities as well. It includes what we typically think of as heart. And sometimes the word citta is translated as heart or heart-mind. There wasn't, I think, so much of a distinction between heart and mind in the days of the Buddha, and in fact going to Asia. When I was talking to one of my teachers, I was having an interview with him, and he said, watch your mind. Your mind is located in your chest, just to the left of center. Okay, that wasn't where I had thought of my mind being located. But this is the sense that the mind, heart, is one thing. And so mind we're talking about here is not it's not simply what we think of as the mental processes, but it includes kind of a broader range of heart and mind. Then the words defiled by adventitious defilements. I'll get to luminous in a minute. Luminous is this mind, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. This is a translation by a person who's very careful about the words he chooses for his translations. And so I actually looked up the English definitions of these words just to get a sense, because he's very precise with his language. I mean, defilement is a weird word. You know, it's not one we use a lot in our daily life. It doesn't come off my tongue. It doesn't trip off my tongue that often. But the definition of defilement that may be being pointed to here, one of the definitions was to corrupt the purity of, to corrupt something that is pure. So defilement has this sense of obscuring, blocking, getting in the way of something that is already kind of naturally pure. So that's one reflection here. And then the word adventitious. That's also not a word I use very much. And the definition of this one also, I think, is just right. When I read this, I thought he picked his words really well. Adventitious means not inherent or innate. So, adventitious defilements that defile the mind are qualities of mind that obscure, block the kind of inherent or innate purity of our heart, of our mind, but are not themselves inherent or innate. So luminous is this mind, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. Luminous. The main definition I found of that word was filled with light. It also had a synonym of radiant. And that word resonated for me with particularly what I think may be being pointed to here. Radiance means filled with love and well-being. One definition of radiance, filled with love and well-being. So one way to understand this sentence, luminous is this mind, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements, is that there's a kind of a natural, inherent beauty, purity, love, clarity to the mind, the heart. And yet it is blocked or confused by processes of greed, aversion, delusion that visit, that are not innate, but come in and obscure that inherent radiance. This understanding of what I think the sentence points to is also underscored in a way by what the Buddha talked of as freedom of the eventual, or we could call it a goal in a way of the practice, freeing our hearts from greed, aversion, and delusion. He defined ultimate happiness, ultimate peace, as the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. He didn't define it in terms of acquiring something. He defined it in terms of letting go of things, letting go of patterns of greed, aversion, delusion. And I think this statement, luminous is the mind, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements, points to what happens as we let go. As we let go of greed, aversion, delusion, all of those contractions, all of those clingings, all of those confusions and wantings, what's left is really beautiful. And that's what I'd like to explore tonight, what that might be. What might that luminous mind be? When we think of being absent of things, we often end up thinking nothing there, you know. Sometimes when people hear, well, part of what this practice is about is about letting go of the things that we want, letting go of the ways that we want things and don't want things. We're endlessly pulled between wanting and not wanting. And sometimes people say, well, if I don't want something, why would I ever do anything? What would be there if I let go of that? What would be there if I let go of the way I want things and don't want things? The Buddha pointed to this beauty, this luminousness that's there when we let go. And there are some qualities of mind that he talked about, described, and held a very, in very high regard. These four qualities of love, compassion, of joy, and equanimity. And it's kind of my understanding that as the heart lets go of the way it's contracted, as the heart lets go of greed and aversion and confusion, delusion, it naturally opens to the beauty of love, the beauty of compassion and joy and equanimity. And so the mind that lets go of those things isn't a flat, dull, boring place, but is actually luminous, beautiful. So these qualities, I'd like to spend a little bit of time exploring these qualities with you, see if we can get a sense or a taste of what this luminous mind might be like. First, I'll just say that I think this statement, luminous is the mind, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements, kind of points to two pathways towards freedom, two pathways towards this luminous mind. And one is to essentially study the defilement, study what gets in the way of this luminous mind. The very recognition of the contractions, the holdings, the tightness, the confusion, the wantings, that very understanding begins to help the mind let go and find its way to this natural luminosity, this natural radiance. It's like our mind is searching, it has a homing beacon for this natural radiance, and it's really confused about how to get there. And so this exploring the things that get in the way, the mind begins to understand that they are in the way and that they are adventitious defilements, that they are simply visitors and they are not inherent. They can be let go of. And so that's one way towards this luminous mind. And the other way is to explore the qualities that the luminous mind represents, to explore what it means, what metta means, what love means, what compassion means, what joy means, what equanimity means. So the first is, the first kind of most basic of these qualities is metta, is love. In a way, I think, at least the other three qualities, love, compassion, and joy, are all kind of various flavors of metta, of this open heart. Metta itself is kind of connectivity. I think one of the main experiences of metta is connectivity. It's the open heart, the non-resistant heart, the heart that is receptive and responsive, relaxed, open, kind, friendly. Those are all qualities that are similar or that this quality evokes. Metta itself, the metta that the Buddha is pointing to, is not a conditional kind of love. The love that we often think of when we think of love has some, what's the right word? Well, conditions. I can't, there's another word I'm thinking of, but it's not popping into my mind. It's, sorry? Strings attached. That's a good way to think of it. Yeah, love. Our love has strings attached. You know, it's like, I will love you if you'll do this for me, or I will love you if you love me back. And it's got this sense of not being just unconditional, open-hearted. So the quality of metta is an open-hearted connection, not with any conditions attached to it. And this quality, too, ranges. There's a real range to it. You know, it can be felt just as simple friendliness, kindness, caring. And it can also be felt as a very boundless kind of experience. Just no edges to the quality. So this quality, the sense of this quality might be felt if you think about what might it feel like to see a dear friend after you haven't seen them for a long time. What might that feel like? It's the delight, the joy of seeing them again. Before all of the thoughts come into your mind of, oh, this person didn't do that, or I remember when they did that thing. But just the simple joy of, oh, there's my friend. You know, we have access sometimes to that, just that kind of the initial hit that we have when we see somebody that we care about. Just that initial feeling before our thoughts flood in around things that they've done or not done. I'm going to read some quotes. from Nyanaponika Tara. So this is kind of a description of this quality of love. I'll just read portions of this. Love, without selecting and excluding, knowing well that to do so means to create love's own contrast, like, dislike, dislike, aversion, and hatred. Love, embracing impartially all beings, not only those who are useful, pleasing, or amusing to us. Love, embracing all beings, be they noble-minded or low-minded, good or evil. The noble and good are embraced because love is flowing to them spontaneously. The low-minded and evil-minded are included because they are those who are most in need of love. In many of them, the seeds of goodness may have died merely because warmth was lacking for its growth, because it perished from cold in a loveless world. Love, but not the sensuous fire that burns, scorches, and tortures, that inflicts more wounds than it cures. Rather, love that lies soft, like a soft but firm hand on the ailing beings, ever unchanged in its sympathy, without wavering, unconcerned with any response it meets. Love that is strength and gives strength. This is the highest love. So this kind of love, you know, it connects us to others. I thought that's one of the feelings that I understand about this quality, the feeling of being connected to others. But it also connects us to ourselves. And that's one of the beauties of this quality as well, that it's not just about connection to others, but in fact, the love, this kind of metta that flows from us to others, flows because there is that sense of caring for ourselves as well. And the Buddha said, searching in all directions with one's awareness, one finds no one dearer than oneself. In the same way, others are fiercely dear to themselves, so one should not hurt others if one loves oneself. So this understanding that connecting, that connectiveness to ourselves ripples out and connects us to others. You know, this feeling of unconditional love, it may seem scary or threatening or, you know, what do we get out of it, right? I mean, there's always a sense of reciprocity. We want a sense of reciprocity with love. We're looking for love in return. You know, we feel incomplete. We want to feel whole. And we're looking for that love from others to feel that sense of wholeness. And paradoxically, what I found, one very profound experience in my practice, was a time, and some of you I'm sure have heard this before. I've told it several times because it was such a profound experience for me. I had fallen in love with somebody and it was not reciprocated. There was a sense of unrequited love. And for quite a while, I fought with my feelings for him. I fought with my feelings of love for him and thought they were inappropriate. I felt, you know, it's not appropriate to feel this way about this person if he doesn't feel that way back. That was my sense of that feeling. And so I was practicing with it. I was exploring it. I was exploring what that feeling of unrequited love was. And it was probably several weeks, a month, maybe even 2 months of exploring this feeling of love for this person who didn't respond my feelings. And one evening, while I was sitting in my room, feeling those feelings, and something in my mind just kind of let go and said, "What are you afraid of?" And in that letting go, the heart just flooded with the feeling of, "I hope you're happy for this person. You know, just this wish of well-wishing for this person. It's like the gates of my heart opened and just allowed that feeling to flow freely towards that person without any need for anything back. And the surprising part for me in that moment was, and this thought, this was the next thought that really occurred to me, I mean, articulated in my mind. Oh my gosh, this is the feeling I've been looking for in trying to have other people love me. This is the feeling I've been looking for. It didn't need anything in return. And so again, this sense of, you know, wanting reciprocity is actually in the way of our feeling maybe the very thing that we've been searching for. It's quite a powerful quality, this unconditional love. And as I said, it not only connects us to others, it connects us to ourselves. The Buddha was very interested in cause and effect. And I've talked a lot about cause and effect, about all of our difficulties, you know, looking at how when difficulty arises in our mind, the way that we're holding on or pushing away is related to the struggles that arise in our mind. And he talked a lot about this, a lot about how cause and effect lead us into struggle and into difficulty. He also the teachings of the Buddha explore the causes and conditions that lead to these beautiful qualities of mind. And so it is said that the proximate cause of this quality of metta is seeing the good, seeing the beautiful in others. And so one way to begin to explore opening the heart around this quality, reflecting on, just maybe take a moment right now, and for yourself, well, start for yourself, you know, reflect on qualities that you appreciate about yourself. What might be some qualities that you appreciate about yourself? And if you have some difficulty with this, I did when I was asked to do this the first few times. And one of the teachers helped me out in the way and offer helping you out. You know, the fact that you're sitting in this room, interested in listening to a talk about opening the heart, that's a very beautiful quality. The willingness to explore the mind, the heart in this way. It's also a very rare quality. So appreciate that about yourself. Appreciate kind things that you've done. Even simple kind things like taking somebody to an airport or holding a door open for somebody, or, you know, this is one way actually that we can begin to practice this quality of kindness. Find ways to do kind things for people, even simple kind things like letting somebody in front of you in the grocery store, in the line in the grocery store, or maybe even as simple as letting somebody have an easy merge on the freeway. How does it change your own mind to relax and let somebody go first? Just that. It's allowing somebody else to have something easeful. And it also is an act of kindness in your own heart. And those acts of kindness are a beautiful reflection that can support this quality of metta. The Buddha said, whatever one frequently ponders becomes the inclination of the mind. Again, cause and effect. When we frequently ponder thoughts of anger, frustration, confusion, annoyance, irritation, frequently think about what people do that annoy us and irritate us, we're cultivating annoyance, irritation in our minds. And so the Buddha suggests we could also cultivate kindness by consciously thinking thoughts of kindness. And this is the way the formal practice of metta works, the formal practice of kindness, by calling into mind people, beings, maybe doesn't even have to be human beings, but just calling into mind people or beings and consciously offering them wishes of happiness. May you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be safe, may you live with ease. Consciously thinking thoughts of goodwill begins to incline the mind towards that quality. As we explore that practice, one of the things that happens, and this is just a light mention of this, maybe seems paradoxical, but often what seems to happen as we start consciously wishing well to people, you know, bring a friend to mind, may you be happy. Then the mind is going to rant and rave, oh, but they did that thing. Why did they do that thing? And may you be healthy. So the mind will produce reminders or memories of things that are like the opposite of metta. Or it may rather than having that sense of open-hearted, unconditional love, may, you know, wishing metta towards a dear friend or a partner, it may have that sense of stickiness to it. Oh yes, may you be happy, and may you make me happy. You know, so that kind of stickiness to the desire, stickiness to the wish. So, in this practice of bringing these thoughts to mind, it's not actually a mistake that these come to the surface. In fact, one of my teachers had a beautiful way of expressing it. He said, this is from Guy Armstrong, he said that this practice of metta, this practice of reflecting, bringing thoughts of goodwill, of well-wishing to mind, he said, it's like running a metta magnet over your heart. What does a magnet do, he said? It draws its opposite to the surface. And so this practice of well-wishing is actually in some ways designed to bring out the opposite of metta, to bring it into consciousness. In a way, the bringing it into consciousness is what allows it to be released. As if the metta phrases was like soap in a washing machine, you know, pulling the dirt from your clothes out into the water. You know, we don't get angry at the soap in the water that it gets dirty because it's allowing the clothes to become clean. And likewise, you know, the way that the metta practice works is to kind of make us aware, to bring to the surface, and then allow the possibility of what is not metta to be released. So the quality of metta is the kind of the basic quality of the open heart. And that quality has these different flavors depending on what's happening in our experience. Like if we are meeting a dear friend, that quality of openness, connection, that may be the quality that seems obvious. If our dear friend then starts talking about the struggles they're having, a partner that's left them or an illness, that open heart shifts towards compassion. So the quality of compassion is the unconstricted heart as it's meeting struggle, as it's meeting suffering. It's said that this quality is most easily and naturally evoked by seeing a helpless being in distress. So, a child lost in the store, you know, a child without its parent, afraid and confused because they've lost their parent, that may evoke that sense or that quality of wanting to help. The quality of compassion comes not only with the sense of open-heartedness in the face of suffering, but with an inclination to act to alleviate suffering. Not from aversion, not from hatred of the suffering, but from connectivity and wishing the well-being of that being. In my own practice, I've really found that this quality of compassion is very connected to the understanding, the opening to, the wisdom of impermanence. That the more we open to this recognition of impermanence, and the more we let go of resistance to the recognition of impermanence, the more our heart begins to naturally open to compassion. A Tibetan teacher says it this way: when we finally know we are dying, and all other sentient beings are dying with us, we start to have a burning, almost heartbreaking sense of the fragility and preciousness of each moment in each being. And from this can grow a deep, clear, limitless compassion for all beings. Another poem. This is one of my favorite poems. I won't read quite the whole thing, because that's kind of a long poem, but I think this begins to evoke also the connectivity of kindness, compassion, and impermanence. And it's called Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. So there's also a formal practice of compassion, as I mentioned with the metta, kind of a way to begin to evoke this quality. And this one is a little more challenging. With the metta practice, you're calling to mind friends, beings, that you're exploring the connection there. With compassion practice, you're calling to mind beings and the suffering that they're having, the suffering that they're experiencing, and seeing if you can connect with an open heart to them with that suffering. And then making the wish, may you be free from the suffering. May you have ease with this suffering. Just exploring that as a possibility. The action that tends to want to come with compassion needs to come with wisdom as well. There is so easily our subtle aversion to suffering can take us to the place of acting in a way that we think will be helpful when actually it may not be helpful. There's a kind of a poignant story about this. David Brower, one of the century's foremost environmentalists, the founder of the John Muir Institute, Friends of the Earth, and the Earth Island Institute, tells the story of one of his earliest adventures as a naturalist. At the age of 11, he collected some eggs of the western swallowtail butterfly and kept an eye on them as they hatched into caterpillars, which later turned into chrysalids. Finally, the first of the chrysalids began to crack open, and what Brower saw was this. The emerging butterfly struggled out, its abdomen distended by some sort of fluid that was pumped out over its wings as it hung upside down on a twig. Half an hour later, it was ready to fly, and it took off. As the other chrysalids began to crack, however, Brower decided to make himself useful. He gently eased open the crack to facilitate the butterfly's emergence, and they promptly slid out, walked around, and one by one dropped dead. He had failed to realize that the exertions he had spared the butterflies were essential to their survival, because they triggered the flow of the fluid that had to reach their wings. This experience taught him a lesson he was still talking about 70 years later. What appears kind and is meant to be kind can be the reverse of kind. And so taking action out of compassion does require us to be really clear about our motivations. Are we simply trying, in a way, to spare ourselves from seeing the suffering? I think this happens a lot to us when we have a friend, for instance, who is struggling and perhaps telling us of a difficulty, how much we want to jump in and tell them how to fix their problem, or, you know, where they should go, or what they should do, or what medicine they should take, or what doctors they should see, or we're full of things that people can do to get rid of their suffering. And some of this, I think, is coming from that place of real wanting to help to alleviate their suffering. And yet, some portion of it, probably a good portion of it, is coming because we are uncomfortable simply sitting with the suffering. We're uncomfortable being with the suffering of others. And sometimes that willingness to sit with the discomfort, the suffering of others, can be one of the most beautiful gifts that we offer them. The willingness to meet someone and say, wow, yeah, that sounds really hard. That sounds pretty difficult. Sometimes that being seen, being met in that way without resistance to the suffering, that itself is very healing. This open heart also can meet happiness. The friend that comes to see us, and we have that moment of connection and joy, the quality of metta, and then they start telling us how well things are going for them. And sometimes, well, this is where the quality of sympathetic joy, of joy, can arise. And often what happens for us is the far enemy of sympathetic joy, something like jealousy or envy can arise. That it's hard for us at times to take joy in the joy of others. That we have this belief, I think one of the reasons why this is challenging for us is that we have this belief that there's only so much joy to go around. You know, that's what we think, that there's only so much joy to go around in the whole planet. And if somebody else has some, it means I'm missing out on some. That's what I thought. It became very clear to me at some point that I thought happiness was a zero-sum game. And yet, actually, happiness can grow itself. Because there is this possibility of taking delight in the delight of others. The Dalai Lama, however long ago it was, maybe 10 years ago or so, said, it's really good to learn how to take joy in the happiness of others, because then you increase your chances of joy 6 billion to 1. So this quality of sympathetic joy, the possibility for it, I think one of the ways to evoke the sense of it most easily for us is around seeing the happiness of babies. You know, just if you have a child in your life at all, a child, or even, you know, just seeing a child on the playground, generally we don't begrudge babies their smiles. So we can kind of take the unalloyed delight in their delight. Just that, the simple joy of a child learning how to walk on an uneven surface or taste something new that they've never tasted before. Just, you know, the delight that that they can have. That can give us a sense of the flavor of this quality of sympathetic joy. Someplace in the texts, it probably is in the commentaries. I think it's in the commentaries and not in the words of the Buddha himself. It says that it's actually, this is a hard quality, that this quality of feeling joy for the joy of others is one of the ones that is a little bit harder to cultivate. It's pointing to deeper kinds of holding in our hearts. You know, the sense of, why not me? Why can't I have that? You know, that feeling a little self-pity or that wish that you could have the happiness that somebody else has, that's pointing to a deeper kind of holding in our hearts. And so it is, I think, in some ways, when we do start to feel the happiness of others, it's a pointer that our hearts are really starting to let go. Because it is said that it's easier for us to feel compassion for complete strangers than it is for us to feel joy at the joy of loved ones. So that the quality of sympathetic joy is, the cultivation of that quality is helping us to let go of some of the deeper kinds of clinging in our heart. And as with compassion, there's a kind of formal practice that can come with this. And this is a practice where we bring friends being to mind and call to mind their success, their joy, their well-being, the good things that are happening for them. And we wish for that to continue. May your joy and happiness grow. May your joy be abundant. And so we cultivate that wish for them. So these qualities of love, of compassion, of sympathetic joy are balanced by a fourth quality, a quality of equanimity. Equanimity is a balance of mind that helps us from being kind of knocked off balance by the suffering and the joy. The kind of, we could almost be whipsawed between joy and sorrow without this quality of balance, this quality of the mind that opens to and allows both the joy and the sorrow. The quality of equanimity for others can be challenging, particularly for people that we love, for people, children, parents, people very close to us, especially when we see that they're suffering or making choices that are heading them into struggle. The reflection on equanimity is a reflection about the fact that people have to make their choices for themselves and they have their own journey through this terrain of joy and sorrow. And the reflection also includes a reminder about cause and effect, that the choices that we make are the seeds that we sow that lead to our happiness or our suffering. And so the reflection on equanimity around others is something like, I'll say this in a kind of a non-formal way. I deeply love you, and yet I cannot make your choices for you. Your happiness depends upon your choices, not upon my wishes for you. So the kind of acknowledgement that people make their own choices and reap the consequences of their own choices. Acceptance is a huge part of this. It's a lot about impermanence. This poem was given to me by Victor Medina, who died earlier this year, a Sangha member who died in July. And this was a poem that he found spoke to him in his last years of life. He had a cancer that he knew would kill him at some point, and so he was going through the process of letting go for several years. And he sent this poem to me a couple of years ago. It's called The Daikini Speaks by Jennifer Wellwood. My friends, let's grow up. Let's stop pretending we don't know the deal here. Or if we truly haven't noticed, let's wake up and notice. Look, everything that can be lost will be lost. It's simple. How could we have missed it for so long? Let's grieve our losses fully, like ripe human beings. But please, let's not be so shocked by them. Let's not act so betrayed, as though life had broken her secret promise to us. Impermanence is life's only promise to us. And she keeps it with ruthless impeccability. To a child, she seems cruel. But she is only wild, and her compassion is exquisitely precise, brilliantly penetrating, luminous with truth. She strips away the unreal to show us the real. This is the true ride. Let's give ourselves to it. Let's stop making deals for a safe passage. There isn't one anyway, and the cost is too high. We are not children anymore. The true human adult gives everything for what cannot be lost. Let's dance the wild dance of no hope. It speaks to the heart that is willing to meet the joys and the sorrows. So, this luminous heart, luminous mind, also is not only about our relationship to others, but our relationship to our own experience, our relationship to our own struggles, our own joys, our own confusion, our own choices, that we can have this exploration of our experience with coming together with this exploration of being aware, mindful of our experience, coming together with this quality of acceptance, allowing, openness, kindness, compassion when there's suffering, joy when there is beauty, and equanimity underlying it all. This is really the heart of non-clinging, the heart that the Buddha talked about, of the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion, opens to this beautiful terrain of love, compassion, joy, equanimity. Appreciating these qualities when they appear, and they appear for us in small ways, in large ways, when we're walking through the world, when we're exploring our own practice, or exploring our own experience, we may find these qualities. This is one of the beautiful ways to actually encourage them along, to recognize them when they arise, to recognize connection, to recognize friendliness, to recognize compassion, joy, balance of mind when they come up. That very recognition, the heart begins to recognize its own luminosity when we see these qualities. And that, I talked about earlier, the heart having its kind of homing mechanism towards luminosity. When it begins to feel those qualities touch into them, it knows very deeply that is the way to happiness. There's no confusion or question about that. It is just very clear. So, thank you for your attention.